Good evening. The fight for the transition. A battle rages in Georgia. Mexico's president sails the dangerous shoals of United States politics, and a mobster who ratted out a terrorist is released from prison. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, November 12th, 2020. Public health officials across the country are gearing up for the biggest vaccination effort in United States history, a monumental undertaking to distribute hundreds of millions of doses to stamp out COVID-19. The task is to figure out who's first in line and make sure people who get the initial shot return for the necessary follow-up. The push could begin as early as next month, when federal officials say the first vaccine may be authorized for emergency use. And more Republicans on Thursday broke with President Donald Trump's refusal to cooperate with Joe Biden, saying Biden is entitled to intelligence briefings, even if they are not ready to recognize a Democrat as the winner of the November 3rd election. One of the issues has been the transition that's been blocked by the Trump administration, as lawsuits have been filed to recount ballots and challenge some voters. None of the lawsuits involve enough votes to change the outcome. That has Biden leading with over 270 electoral votes and more than 5 million popular votes. One of the transition elements is passing on classified intelligence information to both President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Today, Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford says if the White House doesn't provide classified briefings to Biden, he will.
There's nothing wrong with Vice President Biden getting the briefings to be able to prepare himself and so that he can be ready. The president's already getting those. There's nothing wrong with the former vice president getting those. Kamala Harris is on the intelligence committee. She has all the clearances that she needs to be able to do that. There is no loss from him getting the briefings and to be able to do that. And if that's not occurring by Friday, I will step in as well and to be able to push and to say this needs to occur so that regardless of the outcome of the election, whichever way that it goes, people can be ready for that actual task. I can assure you there will be a peaceful transition of power in the United States. I don't hear things other than some of the national media circles that are constantly spinning that Trump won't relent, Trump won't relent. When I talk to his team and I talk to the folks around him, they say that's absolutely absurd. We just want to know all the votes have been counted, that these are legal votes. It is within our right to be able to do that, and we're going to do that.
Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer continued his offensive on behalf of Biden and the reluctance of some in the GOP to acknowledge the Biden win.
This is nothing more than a temper tantrum by Republicans, nothing more than a pathetic political performance for an audience of one, President Donald John Trump. There is nothing, this is nothing, Republicans, like the 2000 election, when the presidential election came down to one state and the difference between candidates was only 537 votes. Joe Biden's victory in the Electoral College has been secured by several states where tens of thousands of votes separate the candidates. Joe Biden leads in Wisconsin by 20,000, Pennsylvania 50,000, Michigan 146,000. That's the facts. Biden's won. Nothing Republicans or Trump can do will change that.
And that's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Final vote counts are still outstanding in battleground states of Arizona and Georgia, where Biden leads, and North Carolina, where Trump leads. None of the states would affect the outcome of the election. Today, Georgia election official Gabriel Sterling announced plans for a hand recount in his state.
Understand when you are really emotionally tied to the outcome, anything you see that feeds your belief is believed by you. That is the rationale. That is the reason we've chosen to do this audit in this time, in this way. This will be the largest hand retallying by an audit in the history of the United States. We understand that. It is a heavy lift. It'll be, as I said, when we were talking about the traditional recount, understand these are two separate and apart things. There is an audit and there is a recount. Two separate statutes, two separate sets of rules.
Georgia election official Gabriel Sterling. Beyond the presidential contest are the undecided races of two GOP Senate candidates who failed to reach the 50% needed to avoid a runoff. Those key runoffs will decide which party controls the Senate in January. Republican Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue will battle it out with Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. Loeffler had this to say.
The road to socialism does not run through Georgia. So you may have heard, now we take Georgia, then we change America. Well, you know what? That's right. No way. Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, you're not going to take Georgia. It's ours.
And that's Kelly Loeffler. Republican Lindsey Graham, who squeaked a re-election in neighboring South Carolina, said he fully supports both GOP candidates.
Yeah, I'm going to donate $1 billion to Senator Loeffler and Perdue for my campaign to make sure they have the resources to combat a tsunami of liberal money about to sink Georgia. The Democrats outspent us in 2020, probably 3-1. Yeah, I'm going to do two things. Give $1 million to help them for my campaign and challenge every Republican who has a website in the Senate and in the House, direct every donation to Georgia. So if you come on to lindseygraham.com, you will find out how to give to Perdue and Loeffler. And every Republican, Mitch McConnell has done this. We've got to get better. I've got 2 million donors. I'm going to ask my donors to help Georgia, and I would encourage every other Republican, just don't go to Georgia, give to Georgia.
And that's Lindsey Graham. The runoff will happen in January, and support from even a defeated President Trump will be key to a Republican victory. And the number of people seeking U.S. unemployment benefits fell last week to 709,000. That's still pretty high, but the lowest figure since March. It's a further sign that the job market might be slowly healing. Yet the improvement is at risk with a sharp resurgence in COVID-19 cases. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Yesterday, our nation suffered a horrifying 144,000 new infections recorded, the eighth straight day of over 100,000 cases being reported. More than 65,000 Americans are hospitalized with COVID, a new record that threatens to overwhelm our hospitals, and our hospitals in rural areas particularly affected. The devastating milestone of 10 million Americans infected has been passed.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Yesterday, eighth day, over 100. 65,000 people hospitalized with COVID. 10 million Americans, more than 10 million Americans infected, and more than 240,000 Americans have died. More than 20 million Americans are on unemployment. An American has 1 million fewer teachers than a year ago. The president and the Republicans in Congress have ignored, by delay, distortion, denial, deaths have been caused. And what are they doing now? Continuing to ignore in spite of these numbers that should be so compelling, that are an imperative for us to act upon this.
And that is the House Speaker. Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine was firm in explaining to Ohioans what was at stake.
We're now seeing a third spike. But this time, things are much different. Now, we had been warned that when it got colder and drier and people were indoors more, the virus would rise up again. It certainly has. This surge is much more intense, widespread, and dangerous. As of today, every single one of our 88 counties has a high rate of virus spread. And areas of our state that were previously untouched, our rural areas, are being hit especially hard. The most COVID patients we ever had in the hospital at one time was a little over 1,100. Last week, we were at almost 2,000 COVID patients in our hospitals. And today, 1 week later, we are now approaching 3,000.
And that's Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The United States elections are being watched closely beyond the southern border in Mexico. The vast nation to the south has suffered from Trump policies on immigration and trade, and its progressive president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO for short, has tried to stay out of Trump's way as he navigates his own country's treacherous politics. AMLO is yet to congratulate Biden, but Professor Gregory Berger of the Autonomous University of the State of Morelos says AMLO is waiting for the right moment. He joins us from Cuernavaca.
There has been a false rumor that Mexican President López Obrador is somehow supporting Donald Trump and that he doesn't plan on recognizing Joe Biden as the president-elect of the United States. That's simply not true. And those who think that it's true are missing a few facts. I think basically this is a theory that has been promoted by the right wing in Mexico to derail López Obrador's presidency. And there's a few things that we have to take into consideration. In the year 2006, when, by all accounts, many people believe that López Obrador actually won that election, but the government of Spain and several Mexican media outlets recognized Felipe Calderón as the president-elect before the Federal Elections Commission had even made their ruling. Because of that, López Obrador, who is very much a man of procedure and legal procedure, and in fact legal procedures that are necessary given the history of electoral fraud in Mexico, knows very well that Joe Biden won that election. Everybody knows that Joe Biden won that election. Donald Trump knows that he won that election. But given the Mexican context, López Obrador is being very careful to follow procedure, and I think will not give his congratulations until the election is certified. He knows it will be certified, and he will give his congratulations. I am absolutely sure about that. But I think that what he's doing is more about the Mexican internal politics. If this had been a Mexican election, the election would already be certified. But as we all know, the procedure for certifying an election is much slower in the United States. The Electoral College has to meet. As soon as the Electoral College has met in the United States, I am sure that President López Obrador will recognize that election. There's one more point that I want to add. I have spoken to some senior officials who served under the State Department under Barack Obama in diplomatic relations with Mexico. Those senior officials, ex-senior officials, who were very likely to be involved with Joe Biden's State Department, know exactly why AMLO is doing this. And they don't mind, and they don't care, and they don't see it as undermining Joe Biden's upcoming presidency. They understand these dynamics. In fact, one of these former senior officials in the Obama State Department, who again is likely to serve under a Joe Biden administration, said to me, I understand what López Obrador is doing because Mexico has always been in a very vulnerable situation. And Donald Trump, being as unpredictable and as spiteful as he is, can still do a lot of damage to Mexico with tariffs or sanctions or any number of measures that AMLO wants to avoid those repercussions. And so AMLO, López Obrador, is playing it very cool. And it's been, in fact, this rumor that somehow AMLO doesn't want to recognize.
And that's Gregory Berger. He adds that criticism of AMLO's seeming capitulation to Trump's anti-immigrant agenda by blocking refugees from Central America on behalf of the United States is a case of survival.
Anybody who's concerned with issues of migration from Central America is certainly concerned and about certain policies that Mexico has been party to and participated with in terms of Trump policies towards migration. It's certainly disturbing and distressing. However, we should also understand why it's happening. And the reason why it's happening is that AMLO has been above all about trying to end corruption in Mexico and try to redistribute wealth in Mexico. That's been his policy priorities. And I think that what he's trying to do is create a relationship that minimizes instability in terms of the bilateral relationship with the United States. It's not something I think that he likes or supports, but I think that it's a pragmatic decision that he's taken to cooperate with some policies that many of us who have been observing migration politics in Mexico for a long time are not necessarily happy with, but I think that we also have a responsibility to understand it. It's a pragmatic decision because the mess that López Obrador AMLO inherited is so vast and so huge that he hasn't been able to address all issues at once. I know that many Mexicans, I'd say the majority of Mexicans, and I would include the majority of Mexicans that still support López Obrador, would very much like to see more friendly migratory policies towards Central American migrants, hopefully with a Biden administration that can happen. It's not about López Obrador trying to mirror what and mimic what Trump is doing. It's a pragmatic decision that he made a decision to be a party to based on calling his priorities. We can at least understand why he's doing it, even if we don't necessarily love it.
Professor Gregory Berger of the Autonomous University of the State of Morales. He joins us from Cuernavaca, Mexico. A Mexican president 100 years ago, Porfirio Diaz, was quoted as saying of Mexico, "So far from God, so close to the United States." In New York City, a frightening rise in COVID-19 cases has state and city officials scrambling to prevent another disastrous lockdown like what happened to the city last spring. Mayor de Blasio laid out the problem.
There's still a chance to turn things around, as always. So number one, a daily number of people admitted to New York City hospitals for suspected COVID-19. That threshold is 200 patients. Today's report is 100 patients with a confirmed positivity level of 36.19%. So again, 100 patients, we don't take that lightly. We want to always have that number be lower. But it has still remained lower than might have been expected. That's something we're watching carefully. The positivity level has gone up, still a lot less than what we experienced in the spring. So this is an area that we're going to be very carefully watching, very concerned about, but one that still remains well within our threshold. Number two, new reported cases on a seven-day average, threshold 550 cases. Obviously, over the last couple of weeks, we've gone well past that. Today's report is 870 cases, a cause for real concern. And then number three, percentage of people testing positive citywide for COVID-19. The daily report, 2.3%. The seven-day rolling average report is 2.6%. So, again, we've seen growth there. But we have still a chance to turn this around before it starts to have more of an impact on our daily lives and on our city as a whole. And this is where each and every one of us have a role to play.
Mayor de Blasio and Staten Island Borough President James Otto focus his attention on conservative residents of his borough who have resisted some anti-COVID measures.
Mayor, I am a born and raised Staten Islander, so that gives me certain privileges, and I can talk about my home community while others can't. And I can admit we are a unique lot. We can be abrupt. I swear we would cut off Grandma to get 10 feet ahead on Highland Boulevard during traffic. But we are at our best in crunch moments, post 9/11, post Sandy. The selfishness that we have is stripped away. We are quickly approaching, if not at that moment, Staten Islanders. Let's rise up to the occasion yet again. I will close with this, Mr. Mayor, and you may think this is corny, but it is in rewatching The West Wing for the upteenth time that I caught a line that I had not heard before. And it's Jed Bartlett, the president, arguing with his wife about a homily in the Mass, and they talk about Ephesians 5:21, be subject to one another. That's the message. Be subject to one another. Wear the mask. Be subject to one another. Keep a safe distance. Be subject to one another. Don't have the gratuitous gatherings. Be subject to one another. Be smart about the holidays coming up. That's the message that I have for Staten Island, as it echoes yours.
And that's Staten Island Borough President James Otto. An ailing Brooklyn mobster, Gregory Scarpa Jr., was awarded a compassionate release today, ending his 32-year sentence for murder. Scarpa, 69, was a former Colombo crime family boss who helped the government probe the Oklahoma City bombing and the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. The son of a crime family associate, Scarpa had been convicted of a 1991 murder in the course of running a racketeering conspiracy. Behind bars, Scarpa became an informant for the FBI, gathering information from accused al-Qaeda bomber Ramzi Youssef, who was implicated in the truck bomb attack on the World Trade Center that killed six and almost collapsed one of the two towers. Scarpa also led the FBI to a cache of explosives at the home of fellow Supermax prison inmate Terry Nichols, who was involved in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. The judge rewarded Scarpa, cutting 10 years off his sentence. Ramzi Youssef is in federal prison. He was convicted of involvement in the 1993 bombing and the 1994 bombing of a Philippine Airlines flight. In 1995, Youssef was convicted in the so-called Bojinka plot to allegedly blow up 11 airliners and assassinate Pope John Paul II. He was sentenced to 230 years. Youssef's uncle is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, being held at the Guantanamo, Cuba base as an alleged ringleader of the 2001 World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks. Retired FBI Special Agent Colleen Crowley was in the agency for 24 years and taught constitutional law and law enforcement ethics to FBI agents. Crowley became a whistleblower about the FBI's pre-9/11 failures. She says the failure to see the 9/11 attacks coming, despite the 93 bombings and other evidence held by the Bureau, including a tip about one of the co-conspirators, led to the attacks in 2001.
Acting supervisor in Minnesota actually told headquarters in mid-August, 3 weeks before 9/11, that this is a guy who could fly into the World Trade Center, quote unquote. So, of course, he foresaw that this could happen, and we actually had this, the guy in custody who was connected to the other hijackers. But they refused to allow further investigation of him. Now, that wasn't so much deliberate as it was a whole series of mistakes. When something really bad happens that traumatizes the country, the people in charge, often with the, you know, kind of psychopathic skills or psychopathic talents, they use that for their own agenda. And that's when I came in and I basically said, hey, let's tell the truth. We still lying to the victims of 9/11. The poor families were not even told the truth, you know, let alone the rest of the country. And still are not being told the truth, by the way, as the government fought tooth and nail to keep from the families suing Saudi Arabia. And if any country had something to do with it, it was Saudi Arabia, a lot more than Iraq and Libya and Syria and all the Afghanistan, all the other countries that the United States launched war on. Because Saudi Arabia was an ally, they covered that whole thing up.
Retired FBI agent Colleen Crowley, she says the FBI's inability to prevent the 9/11 attacks is linked to a culture she compares to martial law, with its roots in a notorious past FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover. Crowley adds the damage to the country has been magnified by the FBI's role investigating charges of collusion between President Trump and Russian leader Vladimir Putin.
Hoover was horrible, and in fact, it's my opinion we've almost gone back to that Hoover era. If you look at during the end of Vietnam, certainly the McCarthy period, the Red Scare in the 50s that led into then the Vietnam War, what Hoover did is he exploited that to spy on anti-war groups, feminist groups, Muhammad Ali. You know, they all were spying on these top, even journalists. The editor of the New York Times was on the list. I mean, it's pretty incredible. Unfortunately, after 9/11, Bush used that then to basically declare under Article 2 that he had all power, imperial president, war powers. It's mostly rooted in both the authorization to use military force and Office of Legal Counsel memos that John Yoo authored for the most part. They've never been rescinded. And so what that did was it almost kind of established a form of martial law. Well, of course, that's good for the FBI. And you see a Comey, of course, first Mueller seizing on this. He did a lot of really kind of fake cases. These were not like the case we had here, which was an actual terrorist guy, a French Moroccan who was going to join the terrorists, etc. No, they were not real ones. They were mostly kind of a lot of them. I shouldn't say all of them, but there were a certain number of them were entrapments. They preyed on people and coerced them through informants, coercive informants. Well, Mueller did that. Of course, it made Mueller look real good. And Mueller also went along with torture. He kept his mouth shut about it. And then you get Comey. Well, Comey feels very empowered when he gets into the presidency. McCabe and Strzok and all the people he had around him. And I think what they did in terms of abusing the FISA process, which was always this worry that they would go around the Fourth Amendment and say it's national security and go to the FISA court. And, of course, in the case of Carter Page, I mean, this is really egregious. They had no evidence at all against him, and they pretty much lied to the court. So you get that happening with Comey, and then you get all of this political, you know, drama going on between him and first the Obama administration, but then secondarily with the Trump administration. And of course, he gets fired, and all of the Russiagate, which is, you know, very specious and really has ever been substantiated, but our mainstream media likes that. And then Ray is basically, he's just another guy that's right in the same mold as both Comey and Mueller. These are guys that come out of the military-industrial complex. Comey was making $7 million working as a vice president of Lockheed Martin right before he became FBI director. And Ray was the same thing. It was one of the big defense contractors, Raytheon or something like that. So they're very much, as we like to say, the blob, you know, the military, industrial, congressional, media, think tank complex, which is also a lot of people just call the blob, the D.C. blob. And that group of people that are really trying to maintain status quo power, they have their favorites. And, you know, if you can wear an expensive suit like Mueller and Comey and whatever, you fit the bill perfectly. And they're going to put you in these positions. And that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a lot of good people. There are a lot of good people, I think, still in government working in all of the agencies. Things can easily get dragged in bad directions. The leadership lately, quote unquote leadership, has not been good. And then you get kind of this bad environment that they're working in that kind of exacerbates it as well.
And that is retired FBI Special Agent Colleen Crowley, who was in the agency for 24 years. James Comey was FBI director. He was fired by President Trump for failing to block the Russian collusion investigation. The current FBI director is Christopher Wray. And that's some of the news for Thursday, November 12th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. Reporting from New York City for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.